Hey guys, it's Ashers.
And Pedo.
So we had this interview that we did a couple of weeks ago with Hank Pattinson. We really enjoyed having Hank on the show. We enjoyed the discussion. It was a great discussion. However, we didn't quite think that it fit the criteria for a typical On Wednesdays We Talk Weird episode.
In fact, it was so groundbreakingly original and so awesome and so off the charts that we thought that it would be a great opportunity to kind of start a spinoff project, interviewing different creative types that make different stuff.
And, you know, Pat and I both, we have, aside from, you know, myself, everybody knows I'm a full-time Freudian investigator, right? So, I mean, the world of the weird's a given. However, I kind of have a background, if you guys follow me on social media at all, in like the horror community. And, you know, Pat's also, he's a filmmaker. So we both kind of have this passion for creativity. And, you know, so we decided to kind of do a spinoff about people who make stuff.
Right. That's the only prerequisite for the show and the guests that we'll talk to, is that they make stuff. They work in different creative mediums. Another episode that we did in the past that would have been a perfect fit for this would have been the interview that we did with Tony Walsh, who was a filmmaker from Chicago and kind of had one foot in the cryptid community because he made a movie about the Rake. Mm-hmm. But more or less, that interview was about filmmaking and the filmmaking process. And stuff like that, stuff with what you're about to hear right now with Hank, that's going to be better suited for our new podcast venture, People Who Make Stuff.
So, yeah, we eventually did the Hank episode kind of as a way to introduce the world of, we did it during the month of April when we did the the kind of drugs theme and conspiracy and, you know, government, you know, drug involvement and things like that. And Hank kind of has a hand in stuff like that. So, Pat, why don't you tell us a little bit about Hank?
Yeah, so he's a podcaster and comic book artist. He's the brains behind the Death by Media Man podcast and the videos. He gets into the specifics of what he does with the videos in the show, and it's super creative and super cool. How I came across Hank was through the King Mobcast podcast, which is a podcast that goes through every issue of The Invisibles, which is a Vertigo comic from the 90s. Written by Grant Morrison, who's like super famous now, but this was one of his original works. I think it was one of his first creator owned comics that he came up with. And me and Hank initially bonded over that and found out that we had a whole shit ton more in common. And like I said, there's definitely a lot of hallmarks here of the Wednesday We Talk Weird podcast, but there's also, we felt that it was a great jumping off point just to make something new, which is kind of what I'm all about and what Asher's is all about too, is breaking new ground and making stuff. And that's what our guests are going to be into. And hopefully that's what you're into too.
So eventually, I mean, you know, this episode, it is both Pat and I. Some of the episodes might not be both of us. Some of us might be. I mean, it just depends on kind of scheduling and how, you know, how you guys enjoy the episodes and whatnot. But, you know, for now, we are putting, you know, this one out under the On Wednesdays We Talk Weird, just to kind of give you guys a feel for the episodes themselves and kind of what to expect in the future. But for future episodes, you can find People Who Make Stuff anywhere you listen to podcasts.
Rock and roll.
So without further ado, here is the official, I guess technically it's a lost episode, right? That's kind of fun. That's kind of a scandal.
No, it's not. It's from a couple weeks ago. Jesus Christ.
It was only a couple weeks ago. But all right. Well, bonus content, guys. Without further ado, here's the episode with Hank Pattinson. Let us know what you guys think. The feedback's always welcome. And again, if you like it, make sure that you subscribe to the People Who Make Stuff podcast.
So this week we have Hank Pattinson with us, cyberpunk hillbilly, writer of stories, and feeder of crows. He's responsible for the Death by Media Man podcast and videos. You can find him on Twitter at HLHPATTISON. Hank, how you doing? Thanks for joining us.
I'm doing really great. Thank you so much for having me.
So Hank first popped up on my radar because of another podcast, the King Mobcast, that kind of does a episode, issue by issue breakdown of the Invisibles comic book. And I know we've talked about them a little bit on the show because I've been trying to get them to come on. And unfortunately, schedules have not aligned. So I settled for the next best thing. Another fan of the Invisibles podcast, Hank. And I think that's where we first connected, right? It was probably through that on Twitter.
I'm pretty sure that's how we discovered each other.
Yeah.
Twitter's a great resource, isn't it? I mean, you could just talk to anybody on there, and it's not like Facebook. Like with Facebook, you have to get personal with those people. And like, usually it's like your friends and family and whatnot. You can't post dick jokes on your Facebook page, but you can do whatever you want on Twitter.
You absolutely can. And you can also harass celebrities, which is my favorite part of it. That's why, like, I could take a break from Facebook. I could take a break from Instagram, but like, I need to be on Twitter, and I can have like my Instagram and Facebook private. Like, that doesn't bother me. But having a private Twitter is like, why would you even really have a Twitter at all?
Yeah, it's weird, isn't it? Like,
yeah, I never understand that.
Yeah, if you can't harass Elon Musk, like, what's the point of being on there? So like, that was, I think, honestly, it probably wasn't the Invisibles that first put you on my radar. I think it was the episode of your podcast that you did where you were talking about slapstick, which is so like bizarre to me, because that was one of, like, I don't know why it was such an influential comic for me in the 90s, but it was something that I like latched onto as a kid, and it was only 4 issues. It was a mini series, and I didn't even know that they brought the character back and kind of rewrote him into I don't know, whatever groups he was in and stuff. But I know that other artists or other writers have used him kind of within the past couple years for stuff. But just as a kid growing up, it was this comic that like just kind of gelled with me. And to see somebody else actually go through the trouble of creating a podcast episode about it, like, blew my fucking mind. And that's exactly what you did.
Slapstick is something really special, but it's not just slapstick. I think the really cool thing about slapstick is, for me, it's Lynn Kamansky. Lynn Kamansky, who created Slapstick with James Frey. The other two big projects for me from him around that time period was, that's when he was doing Ghost Rider 2099 and he was doing Morbius, which I think for like 90s comics, are all three of those are these massive fucking overlooked gems is such a cliche, but I work in a fucking comic book store, so a lot of those tropes just come out of my mouth accidentally. Have you read Ghost Rider 2099?
No, I didn't get into a lot of the 2099 comics. The Spider-Man one I read for a little bit, and that was about it.
Okay, here's what's going to happen is, like this is going to be some fun foreshadowing. Okay, everybody who's listening out there in Radio Land. I'm going to send you a link to Ghost Rider 2099, and we're going to do a follow-up conversation about that, because it is the singular, I don't even give a fuck about Transmetropolitan. I mean, I do, but Ghost Rider 2099 is the greatest and most beautifully drawn and written cyberpunk comic you will ever fucking read, where it's Ghost Rider fucking kills cops. There's a bit where he's killing these cops and he's like, fucking, what are you, serve and protect? Where's the justice for me? Hey, I mean, I don't want to do emulations of it here, but I'm just going to tell you, it's Lynn Kamansky is a fucking, he was an anarchist in that same way of Grant Morrison, like somebody who fucking like put it in his work and was kind of a punk rock asshole about it. Like, even just, you remember there's Ramones references, which I know seems superficial and slapstick, but who else did it?
Not
who
back else then,
said
it wasn't.
Shit like that, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Back then it actually meant something.
Well, I always, like, in Slapstick, there's that bit where they're talking about going to a Ramones concert and they sing a little bit of 24 Hours or I Want to Be Sedated. We didn't fucking have YouTube. I'd never heard that song before. And I remember going to school and asking friends of mine, what do you think this song sounds like? And then fucking like flash forward to now. And it's like, oh, that's one of the most famous fucking punk rock icon songs of all time. Like, it's a very obvious reference to make. I didn't fucking know what that was when I was living in Northern Canada in the mid 90s.
Yeah, I'm a huge Undertones fan, and I got that 100% from the Invisibles. And yeah, it was that was geek culture back in the day, is that everything was, it was hand-me-down. You know what I mean? Somebody had to tell you about something, because you weren't going to, if it wasn't mainstream, you weren't going to read about it. You weren't going to see it. You weren't going to hear it on the radio. If you were lucky enough to have a college radio station in your town, maybe you caught some stuff on there. But then once again, it depended on the DJs. And as someone that worked in college radio for a couple of years, some of the DJs played the same shit that you would hear on the mainstream radio stations. They weren't trying to break new ground or play new shit.
And I wanted to stay on the air, so they had to play what people wanted to hear and, you know, just fucking play me that hit song again.
Right, right. And it comics, I think, were another medium for an information exchange, for stuff to get kind of passed along and for you to be exposed to stuff. If you didn't see it on, you know, network TV, if it wasn't on, you know, ABC, whatever the Friday night like sitcom block was, you know, that's what comics kind of filled that void for. So I'm sorry, what were you going
to
say?
Oh, I was going to ask, with The Invisibles, did you ever get a chance? Did you read it in singles or did you read in trade?
So you know, I think about this when I listen to the Mobcast, because I'm trying to figure out exactly when it came in. I know that I must have started at the end of volume 2 or during the break from when volume 3 started. Because I know that I read volume 3 in its entirety. And that was before everything that Grant Morrison had ever written had been collected in trade paperback. So you would have like his first 7 issues of Animal Man that you could pick up, but that was it. Right. Or I think there was the first trade for volume 1, and there was probably like they were starting to trade volume 2. But I remember when we got to when I started reading volume 3, I didn't know who the fuck any of like the Division 6 people were, because they were not mentioned in volume 2. And because they had not trade paperbacked volume 1 yet in its entirety, there was a lot of gaps. And when I got to the end of The Invisibles Volume 3, it was kind of anticlimactic for me because I didn't really have a full grasp of what the fuck was going on. It really wasn't until which is fine. I mean, now I have the huge omnibus thing now that I probably read once a year. But I read it when it was in its issues, but I didn't probably grasp in its entirety until it was completely collected in trades, which was probably another, I don't know, 2 years later, 3 years later.
I think that's actually really close to what my experience was to some regards as well, where at least you like reading it all piecemeal, getting volumes 2 and 3 long before volume 1. And again, that thing of like, I kept waiting for all these pieces to be revealed. And then once you see it all, it's like, oh no, a bunch of these things were just mysteries that were never fucking revealed.
Right.
What the fuck? Like, this always sticks out in my head of like that bit when they're invading Mason Lang's compound. And there's the dude who says to King Mob of like, you remember me when I was standing by the flagpole? I thought that dude was going to be something for a really long time. And now when I look back and I'm like, oh, that was just a throwaway bit of weirdness in a single panel. It had no impact on anything that I've ever found in any of the rest of it.
Yeah, it was interesting, like the stuff that like that he dovetailed back around in volume 3, and then the stuff that was just kind of a mystery the whole way out. But I did read JLA, his whole entire run of that. I read comics back in like the 80s and 90s. When all that stuff was kind of on. But even then, I wasn't like super following anything. It was like, I always seemed to have like a few random Claremont X-Men issues that would be like part 5 of 8 of some mini series that I had no fucking clue what was going on. Or like, I'd pick up the annuals every once in a while. I wasn't like an avid comic fan. I did read Slapstick in its entirety, which was kind of a not very, wasn't routine for me back then. But when I was in high school, probably like around 95, 96, a comic book store opened by my house, and I went to check it out one day, and I saw the second trade paperback for Preacher, and that had a blurb from Kevin Smith on it. And
oh, that's the first one, I think. I'm sorry, I'm nerd-splaining. I'm so sorry.
No, it might have had a quote from him on the first one, and the second one was the one that he wrote the foreword for.
Because they made fun of him for the first one. Yeah, that's
better than going to the movies, you know, especially one of yours.
Maybe one of yours. Yeah.
So, so that was kind of my reintroduction to comics, was Preacher. And so I had gotten the first 2 trades of that, and then I started reading it religiously. And from the letters to the editor column, of course, then I would read anything Grant Morrison or Garth Ennis did. I read all of Hitman. and never went back and picked up the Hellblazers because, once again, they weren't collected in trades, and the single issues were, like, really expensive, and I knew that there was way too much with Constantine and all that shit, and I was just like, I'm not getting into that. But then he would Garth Ennis would always pimp Grant Morrison and checked out JLA and probably he did some Flash crossover stuff. And I think that was just kind of it from there. And then those were the two authors that I followed. And I always followed the writers. I didn't necessarily care about the characters so much. But Peter David was another one I picked up on. I read his Supergirl run. Yeah, that was pretty solid. The Flash was the only comic book character where I would check out no matter who the writer was, because I really liked, at that point, they were trying to incorporate so much like fringe science into like what the Flash could do based on like how we understood physics at the time. You know what I mean? It just seemed like they were, that was always more interesting to me. It was kind of nerdier. And Wally West was just kind of like a doofus, and I liked Impulse. I liked the whole entire Impulse run for some fucking reason.
Well, and then, I think of all that, I think that's all like, again, that's a big Mark Waid section, and a section of time when Mark Waid was just really fucking good, like just nailing it. Like, I think that's around, I forget, there's a couple of other really big titles he was doing around that time, and they're just, it's Kingdom like a Come? Real solid meat and potatoes.
Was Mark Waid Kingdom Come?
That's what I was trying to remember. I'm pretty sure Waid is Kingdom Come.
Yeah, a lot of his stuff was kind of like, I don't know. Like, I put him in the same camp as, like, Ron Mars or, like not bad. But, they like, if you saw their name on something, you knew it wasn't going to be shitty. But it wasn't the same way that, like, some Joe Kelly stuff was. Or, like, or Garth Ennis or Grant Morrison or one of those guys where you were like, oh, fucking cool. You know what I mean? Like, it wouldn't be edgy, I guess. And as a teenager, no. That was very important to me, was that it was like either edgy or it was Grant Morrison's JLA, which was like non-edgy, but like super fucking heroic and like epic, you know, in its own right.
Yeah. Sometimes I go back and I try to like pick apart the pieces and discern exactly what it is that makes that run of that Justice League so good. I got this theory about writing, which is, I don't know, it's not much of a fucking theory on anything, but like that when you're looking at any piece of something in terms of a story, there are two aspects of it. There is, there's what it's about and there's how it's written. And there's stuff, did you ever read Poppy Z. Bright?
No.
It's a vampire novelist. They transitioned halfway through their career. They're a really interesting person, but, I don't give a fuck about vampire novels, but this person's style of writing was so fucking fun to read that I didn't care that they were writing about something I didn't care about. Whereas the flip side is there are things where it's like, you know, I just like reading about this thing. Like you said, with the Flash, like there's things where you just like, I don't give a fuck. I just like being in this world.
Yeah. Yeah. I hear you. Yeah, that's kind of what we were talking about, that Manson book today that I was reading, and that was kind of the basis of a show that we did, which I won't play with like dates and times now because it'll get all fucking confusing. But
yeah, don't confuse the audience. Leave them alone. We tried that, but it didn't work.
They're probably already thrown for a fucking loop in our 15-minute diatribe about comics that only us appreciate. But The Manson book kind of, it's one of those things where I loved it because it dealt with Charles Manson. It dealt with the lurid sex and drugs landscape of the 60s. It dealt with the CIA and conspiracies, and it dealt with drugs and MKUltra. And if I think I was like a true crime aficionado reading that book, all the non-true crime stuff could potentially bore me. Or if I was a conspiracy nut, I wouldn't want to hear about, you know, drug parties with Warren Beatty and Roman Polanski in Hollywood in 1967. But as you know, one of those things where it was a well-written book, but it also covered all these different topics that kind of like flipped my switches. So it just happened to become like this perfect read for me. But let's talk about the Invisibles a little bit, because that, I feel like that ties in closer to like this show. And once again, it's also kind of where our paths first intersected. What first drew you to the Invisibles?
For me, it's funny. You were talking about Garth Ennis. So read comics all my life. discovered Preacher through Wizard, and then I picked up this book called Writers on Comic Book Writing. It was a book of interviews. Have you read this?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So that was my introduction to Grant Morrison. I was reading it. I picked that thing up for the Garth Ennis interview. I had no idea who Grant Morrison was. And then I read this dude talking about that he saw aliens. And the thing that always touched me about it was that he didn't sound insane, that he knew that he was talking about a personal subjective experience. And at the same time, he was talking about fucking aliens and magic like it was a real thing without being like an asshole about it. And it was based on that I was like, all right, I want to fucking read this guy's works. I want to see what he's all about. And fell into the Invisibles, fell into it in that way that you do when you're fucking like 19 or 20 and you don't have anything to believe in. And then he offers you this thing. And then fucking suddenly it's 20 years later and you're 42 and you're working at a comic book store with a couple of dorky tattoos. And you're like, what the fuck is going on, man? But this part's fun. So.
Yeah. So for our audience, and I've tried to get Asher's to read The Invisibles and she's been hesitant. Although I just suffered through 400 pages of that fucking Manson book. Like, trust me, if that was for me,
that's not.
I did it for the show. I did it for our art.
Well, you still haven't watched Repo, the Genetic Opera yet. So
have you watched The Men Who Stare at Goats? All right. Then I watched Shin Godzilla. I watched Shin Godzilla for you.
And it was worth it. So
it was awesome. Yeah, it was fucking awesome. But so Grant Morrison and the Invisibles, and it was Hash. It was not DMT. But he, to talk about Grant Morrison first, you have to talk a little bit about Alan Moore. And back in the 80s, Alan Moore is the guy that's responsible for Watchmen, which, of course, by now everybody knows the Watchmen franchise. Okay. And he kind of had this persona of being like this magician type guy that, yeah, he was a comic book writer, but he was very much into the occult, and he would put stuff in his writing. And I guess Swamp Thing had a lot to do with the occult. I never read it. Were you the one that recommended Promethea to me?
Oh yeah, you really need to read Promethea.
I did. I read the whole fucking series. Right. Yeah, it was okay. Why do I need to read a comic based on the fucking tarot deck? Which is what he did. It's the kind of stuff that he does, right? Where he does, it's all about, you know, Egyptian mythology and the cycle of death and rebirth and all this shit. And hold on, just let me do the Alan Moore thing. So like, that's who Alan Moore was, and he was very big in the 80s. And Grant Morrison was kind of, initially at least, and I think he's definitely surpassed this, but he was kind of like Alan Moore 2.0, where if Alan Moore was this curmudgeon-y old, like, ceremonial magic type guy, Grant Morrison was like the drop acid, raver, you know, type chaos magician. That talk to aliens and all this shit, right? So that was kind of his persona. And the interview that he gave in the book that you had mentioned, he talks about an incident where he was in Kathmandu, and he smoked hash, although it sounds like a DMT trip, which maybe it was, but I want to say it was hash. And basically he met, he had contact with some kind of intelligence from outside our dimension. And the things that he was shown and the things that were downloaded into him kind of formed the basis of the comic book, The Invisibles. And The Invisibles has a lot of magical subtext to it. And in the letters to the editor column that he would, you know, be in the back of every issue, he very much went into sigil magic and how to do stuff and kind of give, like, you know, just enough information to make people do crazy, dangerous shit. And it kind of, that coupled with, like, you know, it really was this like cultural milestone for its time. Like like we talked earlier about the drugs or the music, but the music and the drugs and the different counterculture things that it talked about. Yeah, it was a comic book about this team of, I don't want to say superheroes, but heroes that are battling against, you know, the forces of evil that are trying to take over our universe. And that's just like a Reader's Digest version of what the story is actually about. But he put a lot of more stuff into it that, like you said, if you were kind of a lost out of high school, you know, 18 to 22 year old trying to figure out what the fuck was going on, this could definitely catch you at the right time and shape the trajectory of the rest of your life, which it did for me too. You know, The Invisibles had a huge, huge effect on my life.
And that's what it was designed to do. You know, he talks about that so much about the, like, The Invisibles was a spell designed to create Invisibles agents. And now here we all are, the fucking bastard children of Graham Morrison with all of our fucking little annoying podcasts. Great.
Yeah, he kind of fucking abandoned us. But
he really fucking did, and I have some very strong feelings about that. I don't know where the fuck that dude's at anymore. Like, I don't know, man. I don't know. I fucking did you read Annihilation?
No. The last thing I read by him is I've subscribed to Heavy Metal magazine for fucking probably a decade now, and when he took over as editor in chief, that was like, I don't know. I that was huge for me. Obviously, I was a Heavy Metal fan. I was a Grant Morrison fan. These two things were colliding, and it lasted about a year. And he did some comics in there, but none of them were particularly great. I think one of them had a lot to do with like cats and Nazis or something, as Heavy Metal has a tendency to do. And you know, it was okay, but it wasn't world changing. And then he's not on it anymore. You know, he just kind of shuffled off. So I honestly don't know what he's been up to. But what's Annihilation?
Well, he's been doing Green Lantern for a couple of years now.
Yeah,
people tell me it's great. It's I don't know. It's not Kyle, so I don't care. Is that how shallow I am?
Who's fucking, the Green Lantern now?
It's Hal. He's back to Hal.
Okay, whatever.
It's fine. It's space cop stuff. Like, very literal. Like, I think the first issue says space cop across the front of it or something along those lines. Annihilation. Oh man, this is just, it broke my fucking heart. It was in that same way as like when Elon Musk showed up on Rick and Morty and I was like, cool, I'm never getting this back again. Annihilation, I got about a quarter of the way into it and I was like, it's a King Mob story, but it's about a young fucking Hollywood screenwriter who's writing this epic sci-fi story that's about his own life as he's having a mental breakdown that might be killing him. And then the two lives intersect and have to save the universe and shit. But it's Max Landis. It's fucking Max Landis. Like, it's drawn to be Max Landis. The name, like, I think it's Max Lomax or something. And then I just fucking like Googled Annihilation and Max Landis. And there's this big blurb from Landis saying of like, holy shit, me and Graham Morrison hung out for a while and now he's doing this book that I'm in. And I was just like, cool, super cool, Grant. This is going to age really well. This will age as well as that time the fucking JLA teamed up with Jarrett from Subway.
Yeah, I already think that Max Landis is kind of like already not like, I hate to say canceled, but he's been kind of maligned for the past decade or so,
never thought of very highly. And then like, yeah, I think once people started talking openly about the like, yeah, he's a dick. And then when his project stopped making a lot of money, that's all they fucking really care about is how profitable is this. But fucking, what was that? Bright. Netflix is Bright. I think that bombed enough that he lost a lot of his social cred that way.
Yeah. I mean, his Chronicle was good. I think that was like the high watermark for him. I really like that. And then he had that Frankenstein movie that wasn't terrible, where Daniel Radcliffe played Igor. And that was kind of interesting. And then was it American Ultra? That was his MK Ultra movie.
His super sexy spy.
Yeah, that fucking sucked. I saw that in the theater. And but that was it. And the Bright was, that was the Will Smith is like, it was like Alien Nation. It was like and he's got like an orc partner.
We don't like you orc people in Orc Town. Oh, wait, we only like orcs in Orc Town. It feels like a fucking sketch. Like, it's either fucking Rick and Morty or SNL of just like, even down to the like, what was Will Smith's fucking fairy lives don't matter. I should say really quickly, like, I've spent a bunch of time with Max Landis. I met him at a fucking pizza joint outside a showing of fucking Aliens, and I wound up arranging for him to do a signing at the comic book store. So there's a level of like, I don't want to dig into this too much. I loved Chronicle. Not a real fan of the human being. When I got up close, it was one of those negative experiences.
Yeah, he had there was a lot of shit talking about him on the internet for a very long time before I realized he was in about him. The Timmy Spielberg stuff. Did you ever come across that?
No.
That was like when that was his alias. When people would shit talk him online, they didn't want to talk about him directly because he was such a troll, and he would like go after people. And he's one of these people that like Googles his names and looks at everything that people are saying about him. So they used the code word Timmy Spielberg, which if you think about it, makes sense. And they've been shit talking him since I think message boards were created.
But, So yeah, to hear that Graham Morrison fucking like took acid with him in Las Vegas and then did this book, I wish Morrison was doing other stuff. I've heard this thing, not to be a rumor monger about it, but like people, like he doesn't do any of his own online media. Like he doesn't touch computers that are connected to the internet anymore, like some weird version of a Luddite. It's all done through someone else. And like, I thought he would be one of those dudes like, I know Warren Ellis is a little difficult to bring up now, but like Graham Morrison, I thought was going to be one of our like kings of the internet, like a dude who was like super like tweets 1,000 times a day and is weirdly interactive. But I mean, maybe the flip side is he's trying to get some fucking work done.
That might be it. And it might be he understands the danger of overexposure. And the more shit you say, the more likely you are to say something that is going to piss people off, or is it going to translate well, or, you know, if maybe he's learned to, you know, because comics, I mean, you're a comic book maker, like you could speak to this. It's not an immediate medium. You know what I mean? Like it takes a while. It's a process. So there's plenty of time for revision and editing and correction and thinking about what you're going to say and going over and over and over stuff again. So tweeting might kind of run counterculture to that. Like it's kind of far removed, you know?
He's also an old man now. I forget how old, but like, you know, it's one of those. He's not just some 35-year-old dude getting on the internet at this point. He's some dude who's been around for it all.
Yeah. Yeah. Ashley, how you doing?
I'm just listening. I don't know anything about comic books, guys. I don't. I have no idea. I saw Batman once. I'm just kidding. I've seen all of them, but I really don't know anything about any of what you're talking about. So.
Well, the invisible, I think we'll just kind of like wrap up like that everything that just kind of from the past. The Invisibles is a good one to read. It heavily ties into chaos magic, the occult, drug use, kink, and you know.
Oh, kink use.
Just counterculture.
Now, yeah. I think that a lot of the audience probably does enjoy stuff like this. And there's, I don't have anything against it. It's just that I don't really, I don't really take in a lot of fiction personally, so it's just not my bag. But I think it is really neat, especially you know, the way Hank was talking about the one guy earlier and how the guy was, you know, talking about like experiences with aliens and all that kind of stuff. And it sounds crazy, but like in the grand scheme of things, it's really not that crazy. It's really not.
No, and I guess like that's. I've made a lot of stuff. I've written a lot of stuff, and I feel like it's not that far-fetched to have you write a story. And if it's a story that's kind of, you have a personal connection with, and then where you're drawing from your own experiences, fiction and reality tends to blend into itself, you know? And it's, there's been times when I've written stories and stuff that I've written has more or less come true in the future, you know? And I don't think that it's necessarily, I guess it's kind of magic, but it's also just kind of like the creative process itself is kind of magic because you're making something out of nothing, you know? And that's brings us to our next thing I want to talk to Hank about is that you make a lot of different shit, you know, which is kind of like why I was like super interested to talk to you because you work in a lot of different mediums. Your podcasts are interesting. It's kind of like, you know, I don't want to say slam poetry, spoken word fiction, you know, those videos that you make, like I'll let you kind of introduce them and give our audience a rundown, but those Friends videos are fucking hysterical.
Oh, the Comrades series, man, that was, that's something that I've always, I had the dream for that like fucking years ago, but it wasn't what it was. What, in my head, it was always going to be a series of really bad, stupid Russian jokes. And then the day I sat down to do that, I like, it's one of those things where like funny Russian jokes are the thing I grew up on. And now it's 2021 and I'm like, ooh, this is kind of hackney and racist at this point. Like you can't just like, now everything is backwards because we talk in Soviet land. And that's when it turned into a strange horror series. It was like, cool, then I'll just go in a sort of like, do you, have you ever gotten into the Flesh Interface series?
No, what's that?
Man, again, this is one of those there's a full episode to be had. Somebody out there started writing these responses to random threads on Reddit. And if you put them all together, they start telling this alternate reality story that involves these flesh interfaces, which are like pods of pulsing flesh that are sort of doorways to other dimensions, but everything that passes through them seems to die, except occasionally they put little children through and they come back with their blood all full of LSD and covered in strange membranes. But it was all done by this fucking, just this random person nobody knows anything about online. And I got really into that for a little while. And it worked as a really nice, like that's, there's a lot of that that went into what the Comrade series became of trying to sort of explore that form of body horror, alien shit.
It felt to me more like, did you ever listen to Welcome to Night Vale?
Oh yeah.
It was like good Welcome to Night Vale. Like I like Welcome to Night Vale, but sometimes I feel like they don't quite get what they're lampooning. You know what I mean? Like they don't quite have the hang of the dread and like the horror part of it.
It's definitely a little cutesy.
Yeah. And you did, like, for you, it was definitely more like, fuck. So just explain like to our audience real quick, like what Comrades is.
So Comrades is I'll give you the whole process on it. I mean, funnily enough, like it's a closed series now. Like the last episode of it has come out, but basically I take an episode of Friends. I crank down the resolution. I slow it down to about 75% speed. I strip out all the audio and dub it all with sections of a Polish novel that I found online. And then I subtitle it all with an ongoing sort of evolving story of strange horrors. You know, it started out as being a very random stream of consciousness thing at first, and then you get a couple episodes in and suddenly you have a continuity. Suddenly you know that like that Ross is the one who has the dreams and no one likes the dreams. They were a pleasure to make. That was the thing that was really fun about that, is that it was an almost like, it was like just throwing paint on a canvas.
Right. And it's available on YouTube, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I put them all up in like, yeah, each episode is like 1.5 or 2 minutes long at the most. And now that's sort of being subsided, followed by, we live right. within, fuck, I don't even remember what my own titles are now. We live with an undefinable horror. Jesus Christ.
That's with the kids, series. Where the kids disappear.
No, that's the, it's a new similar dubbed format thing where I'm taking, see, the reason I stopped doing Comrades is because, you ever get into the fucking, what is it? Pork chop sandwiches.
What, like actual
like actual there were a bunch of G.I. Joe PSAs that somebody did a huge big redub on, and those were one of the first big viral things.
Yeah.
But when I was looking into it, they do run into that thing of like, eventually if you become popular enough, you may get that shit stricken down by the copyright holders. So that's why I hit a point with Comrades where I was like, if I keep doing this long enough, I don't want these to all get fucking taken down off of YouTube because I'm violating some copyright thing. So that's why now I'm trying to just work with old public domain black and white TV shows.
Yeah. Yeah. And so you just, yeah, that's really cool. And then you also do comic stuff, right? You have a comic with one of the Mobcast guys, right?
I do. Brendan and I did Techno Crappers, which we're sort of doing as a series of strips, basically. We're trying to, we've worked on some other stuff before. He did the initial illustration for the Freerunner for my comic book Vigilante audio story series. And yeah, since then we'd sort of toyed around with stuff, but Techno Crappers, it's sort of semi ongoing, you know, like they're just strips, so I can keep doing scripts and he can keep, you know, do a panel or two whenever he can.
And all the stuff that you make, like, does it come kind of from the same place creatively? I mean, obviously they're different stories, but is there like a unifying thread that like brings them together, you would say?
On a good day when I'm not just fucking faking it and being a hack, I like to hope that you sit down with a new project and you think about the combination of like what's missing, like what's out there that I really wish that I was reading right now that I don't have a chance to read. And then a combination of also like, what do I fucking love? I love Preacher. Why? What are the little moments of it? And I think of that stuff in that sort of, it's that very Tarantino-y sort of approach of like, yeah, man. And then you just fucking steal like a motherfucker. You find the stuff you love and you just fucking rip its guts out and you dress yourself up in them and nobody knows or cares anymore. Like, what is the fucking like hack, steal, great artist, plagiarize, or the other way around, something like that?
Yeah. In America, we call it stealing. And in France, they call it paying homage.
Exactly. So, you know, I mean, I can see the things that are inside of me that keep bubbling up no matter what, like fucking, hey, it's funny. This doesn't show up in a ton of the stuff that I'm doing currently, but like, I can't stop writing about young mutant gangs beating up cops. I can't get it out of my fucking head. It's like I got to do this right. 'Cause I can't fucking stop doing it.
Yeah, I have that same thing where like I make a lot of short films. I used to make more, but I still average about one or two a year. And everything that I feel like I do with film comes from either Repo Man or Streets of Fire. I don't know. Have you ever seen Streets of Fire?
I haven't seen Streets of Fire.
All right. It's kind of it's a Walter Hill movie, and it's with Willem Dafoe and Rick Moranis and the Commodores and not the Commodores. What fucking band is that? I don't know. But it's Jim Steinman did the music for it, RIP. And it says on the cover, it's a rock and roll fairy tale. And it's very much I can't really describe it, but it's like, you know, good guys and bad guys and bands and cars and motorcycles. And it's very pulpy. And it came out in the early 80s, and it's larger than life, but it's not super, it's not like campy or anything. And it's one of those things where it's not readily apparent that everything I do tries to be like that, but it's an influence that was so profound that it's felt on everything that I do. Especially with Repo Man, with the genre bending and the comedy and the sci-fi and the way that like how layered everything is in that movie and how you can, you know, you have to watch it really a couple times to get how everything is constantly interweaving with each other and what a small universe, small but very dense universe that film creates. And that just kind of captivated me as a storyteller to have that much control over the environment and the screen that you can kind of make something that compact, but at the same time that like cheap and punk rock, you know. So those are two that had a huge influence on me. And it seems like with a lot of the stuff that you do, like you said, there's a kind of obviously it all comes from the same place. You're the creator, you know. I don't know where I was going with that.
Well, I definitely like I got my handful of things like that. Like for me, like the original black and white Ninja Turtles were a real seminal fucking thing for me. And like, you know, I've mentioned Tarantino a couple of times. Like when I was 14 or 15, I guess my dad took me to theater to see Pulp Fiction. And like, there's, okay, here's a thing that I think about, and this kind of gets back to Graham Morrison as well, like a fixation that I have. I love the fucking Wire, right? Like the Wire is the greatest TV show ever made, but I can't turn off the part of my brain that whenever I'm fucking watching it, there's always this part of me that's like, so what would happen if Angel from Buffy were in this series? Like what do you do then? What do you do then if you don't lose the caliber of storytelling that's being told, but you introduce fucking Spider-Man to this? And I think that's what I loved about Grant Morrison is that he does this thing where he takes these really weird fucking concepts and then you humanize the fuck out of them. You really show human beings having a visceral reactions to the unknown or the unexplainable. I don't know. There's something in that that I really like.
Yeah, I mentioned my son earlier. I was able to name him Connor. because I'm such a huge fucking Angel fan. And yeah, that makes his mom Darla, but we'll leave it at that. So yeah, I completely agree. I feel like those are both high watermarks for when it comes to storytelling on TV. Definitely The Wire. The Wire, I watched that. I had just started a job working midnights and I kind of asked my coworkers, well, what do you do on midnights? There's not really a whole lot going on. And they were like, I don't know, you drink or you sleep. And I was like, well, I'm not going to do either one of those things. So I watched The Wire and I probably, and it was over at the time. But it probably took me about 2-3 months to go through the whole series. And, yeah, man, I mean, it doesn't get much better than that. And I really liked, I didn't watch, Treme. Is that the one he did in New Orleans?
I got a little into it, but it didn't have the same pull.
But the porn one he did was really good.
Ooh, I haven't seen that.
Oh, yeah. The Deuce.
Huh.
Yeah, James Franco. It's actually kind of bananas. James Franco plays twins, and one brother is a bartender, and one brother is like, I don't know, he's always in trouble with the mob, and they give Franco a gay bar because the mob used to kind of run the gay bars in New York City because it was a way, you know, the cops wouldn't hassle it and gay people needed a place to drink and shit. So like, they kind of did that. And then through there, he slowly gets into the porn industry. And, it's all about, you know, you talked about New York in the 70s and 80s and how it transitioned from, how the city Times Square changed basically and the porn theaters and all that stuff. It's worth checking out. It's pretty good. And I didn't even finish it, but like, I want to say each season is like 5 years apart and, it's really good cast. Maggie Gyllenhaal plays a hooker that becomes a porn star and basically how like all the early porn stars were straight up hookers and how the pimps kind of lost their business. And when they tried to clean up, you know, Times Square and get rid of the pimps and the hookers, well, then, you know, some of the pimps went out of business and some of the pimps became filmmakers, you know, and it's worth checking out. It's David Simon. Obviously, that's why we're talking about it. But it's pretty fucking solid, you know, and obviously Buffy and Angel. I found those after the fact. I'm not like the crazy Firefly fanatic that a lot of people are.
It's fine. It's
fine. Yeah, and exactly. It's fine. It was one season in a movie. Let's not make more of it than it was, you know. Have you watched The Nevers at all?
No. As soon as that one came up, I knew I was I don't want to say way beyond it, but just kind of done at this point. And the other thing, did you ever read, he did a run on Runaways after Brian K. Vaughan?
No, I never read that. I didn't like his X-Men run, and I kind of gave up on his comics after that because he was right after Morrison on that, and he kind of Joss Whedon,
yeah,
wasn't he? Wasn't he right after?
Oh, X-Men? He was. He followed up Morrison. I think I know exactly what you're about to say. Of like, he specifically was brought in to undo everything Morrison had.
Fuck
done.
That. Yeah, that's when I was like, you know, Joss, like you're all right, but you're not. You know, fucking stay in your lane. But no, Runaways was solid?
No. The thing is Runaways, his thing in Runaways was the characters all traveled back to, I think, the same time period that the Nevers did. There's just a, like, when the trailer for that came out, I was like, oh, this is your runaway story. Or like I see the seeds of this thing that you did before that you're doing now.
Right. Like he's got, like a, in the, he's got a, go on.
Oh, I was just going to say, like, you know, Firefly, the origin of Firefly is fucking Aliens 4, right?
No.
The team of bounty hunters, if you look at that team of bounty hunters in Aliens 4 that Joss Whedon wrote, it's like the smooth-talking, funny leader who's got a black, tough sidekick who kicks a lot of ass and carries a shotgun, and there's the guy no one trusts, and there's the girl who's good at machines, something along those lines.
Ron just like, Perlman is definitely fucking Jane in that. Yeah.
You you recycled a thing. And like, that's, hey, we were talking about this before. Like, I fucking do it all the time. Like, if you fucking ran over all of my work, there's a like, yeah, dude, like, again, it's the like, one of my roommates called me out on it 15 years ago where he was like, you just like things where people smoke weed and listen to hip hop. And I was like, yeah, I do.
Well, there's a lot to like about that. You know,
it's a good opening doorway to a better world.
So one of the things that I had on our list of things to talk about, which now has come up like a fourth time in this podcast, I don't know if our listeners have picked up on it, but you're definitely from Canada.
I've been told that. I had to record something for somebody once and they were like, so your accent is kind of doing something here.
No, it just, but it's funny when it pops out, because it pops out with very specific words, and like, I'm not busting balls about it. Like, dude, it's fine. I talk weird too. I'm from the south side of Chicago, but like, it's just interesting. So, and that was something I want to talk to you about, because on your Twitter, like you're very, I don't want to say like political, but I guess kind of political.
I'm pretty first thing in the morning. It's always fucking first thing in the morning.
But I that's what's really interesting to me, because obviously like I live here and I've been here my whole entire life, and we're both North American scum, but like you're a little bit removed from it. You know what I mean? So you kind of have an outsider perspective looking in. Like, what's been your impression of the States for the past 5 years?
it's been a real bummer, but I don't know. Like, my parents were pretty hardcore lefty, semi-anarchist weirdos, both in very different ways. So I grew up with I realize now as an adult, it's like, oh, those were extreme views. Those were not moderate views I was raised with. And I hold a lot of those same views myself. Like, they were really into the fucking civil rights movement and shit like that. So there's a part of me that has a very like, yeah, I've been saying this for years. I was saying like right around fucking high school, like 96, 97 for me, of like, you know, there's a giant culture war coming. And like, did you ever get into Disinfo?
The website?
Yeah. They did a fucking like a web series at one, or a TV series at one point, and they talked just a lot about the like the fact of like down in the South, just how big the culture war was getting towards raising people with the idea of like, yeah, we're at war. We Christians need to breed like fuck, and we need to be able to take down this fucking army that's amassing on the left. And I've been saying of like, something's like, this is not going to stay buried. Like this culture war is going to come to a head, not to be nihilistic about it, but there's just a like, it's like people talking about fucking climate change 25 years ago. And now you exist today with the fucking forest fires. They are horrible when you see them. And at the same time, it's like, yeah, we saw this train coming. Like, I've been talking about fucking saying neo-Nazis are a real problem my whole life. But always on that thing of like being an outsider kid and constantly trying to say, you guys ignore that the fucking popular kid is a psycho bully, or like you create these excuses of like, well, he comes from a good home, so we can overlook the fact that he fucking tortured one of his classmates. And it's like, there's this, it's so easy to just say a cancer that's brewing within and going ignored, but it's like, it's gonna fucking come to a head. To the point where I know everybody's talked about, like, Trump is a literal movie villain who nevertheless got elected. Like, what the fuck does that say about how different people's views are? It's just very disappointing.
It was something we talked about in the Manson episode that we
recorded. Yeah, we were just talking about that, yeah.
About how people kind of thought that in the 60s counterculture movement, the establishment was so surprised by white middle-class kids taking drugs and getting into like the San Francisco scene, that they were convinced that there was Russian involvement, that there had to be communists that were brainwashing our children, because why else would a 17-year-old white kid from suburbia smoke weed? Jesus, you know what I mean? Because before then, drugs was not, they were not as widespread. And if they were used, they were used by, you know, lower class criminals. It wasn't popular. It wasn't available. And they saw suburbia and middle class kids kind of flock to this lifestyle. And they were convinced it had to be Russians. It had to be communists, you know, or brainwashing us and all this stuff. And it's the same thing with Trump being elected, where you have a lot of the left convinced that there must be Russian collusion because there's no other way that Trump could have possibly been elected. And it's like, no, it's I'm not saying there wasn't. I don't know all the details, and I don't know if anyone does, but it, you know, no, there's enough crazy white people out there that would have voted for that man. And it doesn't need to get any more nefarious than that. We don't need a bigger explanation than that, than just people made bad choices. And going to what you say about, you know, the social engineering and being able to spot it a mile off, I remember in 1998 when like Britney Spears and Christina Aguilera and the first wave of like the teen girl pop icons came out of Disney and saying like, man, they are really sexualizing teenage girls right now. And this is nuts. And I, you know, where is this going to lead? Because like, yeah, there was Madonna, okay, who made a lot of waves back in the 80s. But like, who else were like the teen pop icons? Like Belinda Carlisle, fucking Tiffany. Like they were not overly sexualized. Not to that extreme. Not to what you saw with, you know, Britney Spears and the like. And when that came out, like I was like, this is not going to be good because you're going to have, you know, this is going to lead to this, this is going to lead to that. And sure enough, look at the Disney Channel now. How many of those actresses end up doing softcore porn or have fucking terrible drug addictions or something because they've been abused probably their whole entire childhood, you know? And it was something that if a kid sitting in a high school in Chicago could see that coming a mile off, you're telling me that nobody else did. Right. Nobody else saw the ramifications of teen idols being represented a certain way, the ripple effect that would have on youth culture, you know. And I'm by no means like some puritanical fucking weirdo or anything. I am a weirdo, actually, but not in that way. And I mean, it dinged my radar. So I can only imagine what you're seeing from north of the wall.
Oh. It's. Yeah, I definitely, it's hard to not take in a lot of, you know, all my fucking media is American. And again, you guys fucking live right there. Like all of your stuff impacts us in really big ways, even just to the level of like, you know, all of our fucking comic books are American. The strength of the American and Canadian dollar really changes how much we have to change for charge for comic books, which really impacts how many comic books people buy. So like there's weird levels of like it all fucking interacts in different ways. And again, I don't like to say that we take the lead from you guys, but again, it's a loud cultural voice. The weird thing is like, I assume you've never watched Canadian television.
I mean, Trailer Park Boys, Letterkenny, SCTV.
You should watch fucking Canadian news at some time. Like, destroy your YouTube algorithm by watching some CBC news.
Okay.
Our news presenters, like CBC is the fucking, like, it's the government news. We don't have that hyperbolic thing where all of the news readers are performers on this in the States. Like, everybody, they're... It's much duller in Canada. Everything is so much duller. I went to New York a few years ago and I came home, and as I got off the airplane in Vancouver, I looked around and I was like, this is why everybody makes fun of us. We're just fucking like jeans and flannel jackets everywhere you look. we're a bland people. But anyways, our news readers, when you watch it, there's so much editorializing in American news. Like even when they try not to, even when it's shit that of like, oh, I genuinely like this presenter, they still put all this emotional inflection into everything they say. That's like,
we do pick up on that. Like we know that. Like you're absolutely 100% right. And as someone that like grew up here and raised with that, like, yes, I I know, and a lot of us know, and that's why a lot of us are just like, we don't watch the fucking news, because it's 100%
you can't just watch the news. Every single source of news, every single one of them has some type of bias, be it left or right. Every single one. That there is not a single non-biased publication in America, and if there is, it's just buried by all the big ones with all the money. And so, I mean, that definitely is a it is a problem, because it makes people not trust, and then it makes people, I don't know, even that much dumber, because they assume that the news is a source that you can trust, when, you know, in all reality, you kind of just hear, you really have to go to the horse's mouth to get the actual story.
And then anytime we do get something that's kind of cool and independent, like Vice, I mean, Vice now is obviously a joke and like that, you know, but when it came out back in the day, like it was interesting, and it was new, and it was a fresh perspective, and it felt like
Vice is also Canadian, isn't it?
I don't think so, because the founder is the guy that started the fucking Proud Boys.
Who's a Canadian?
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, no,
you guys are responsible for that.
I the Canadians every level of it is so stupid. Every level of it is so stupid. You guys named yourselves after a song from the musical version of Aladdin, like. Jesus Christ.
I didn't even know that.
No, listen, we don't need to give those people the time of day on. This is not what the show is.
No, definitely.
But my question is, Hank, so, you know, speaking of like, you know, you're again, you're kind of giving your views as a Canadian looking at us from the other side and not, you know, at ground zero. Are your views of how you portray us, are they fringe at all, or is that just kind of how the whole of Canada looks at us and just goes, holy shit? I mean, is that accurate?
I would definitely not want to ever say my opinion is common or mainstream, or like, well, that sounds like I'm trying to be real cool. But I've always had this thing of like no fucking people agree on anything. You know, it's like if you asked fucking like two Christians will still kill the same guy, but if you ask them both to draw a picture of Jesus, it's going to be so different. And like, I don't know what the fuck people around me think. Like, there's still anti-mask rallies in my town. There's still fucking like anti-gay guys with bullhorns doing stupid shit. There's just less of us in these population centers. So like, I hear stupid shit all the time. When the fuck, man? At the start of all this Trump stuff, I remember being in a grocery store and hearing the little old lady ahead of me just saying of like, well, I just don't know how anyone could ever say that Trump is racist.
Oh.
And I thought about screaming at her, but I was like, no, if I then I'm just going to be the dude screaming at a little old lady in a grocery store. Like, then we lose. So like, but like, no, we're really stupid and bigoted and racist and horrible up here. We're not any better. And I think a lot of us like to cling to some sort of cultural identity, but it's like, it's fucking bullshit.
Yeah.
Except for the French, and don't get me started on them. Oh, and the Eastern Canadians. I don't like them either. Ugh, there's no one worse than another Canadian. It's true though. They're all fucking awful, man. Like fucking if you did get me down to it, it's like, oh, Alberta is a fucking nightmare country. Alberta is our version of your Texas. Like they are fully fucking like a weird conservative nightmare.
That's
people
where...
from Newfoundland have fucking allegiance to the fucking deep ones. It's so obvious.
Alberta, that's the other podcast I used to write for their website. They're called Grimerica, and they were based out of Alberta. And it was a really interesting the podcast is still around, but it was really interesting. It was kind of like what we do. And there were these two stoner Canuck guys, and they would have people on, and you know, I had a blog on their website, and I would write about stuff, and they kind of got a kick out of me, and I got a kick out of them. And it worked really well for a while, and stopped writing for them, and just kind of recently poked my head in to see what they were up to. And they are 100% like insane anti-maskers. Oof. To where I think they're selling shirts that have like some that makes some kind of claim that like the vaccine gives you AIDS or something. And I know that it's kind of meant to be a Christ. Joke. I know, right? And I was like, oh my God, what have you guys been up to? So when and I just thought it was like them, or I didn't know if like it was like a Canadian. I know that it wasn't a Canadian thing, but like it was very weird to me that they were like that. And now that you say that like Alberta, it's like Texas, I'm like, there you go. Makes perfect sense now.
Well, and I think, like, you know, I don't know that, you know, the flip side of this is like people have real bad misconceptions about Canada, you know, like the fucking the symbol of the Mountie is one of those like such a Canadian thing. The Mounties, they're very noble. Like, no, the Mounties have a horrible history of racism and sexual abuse. And it's one of those like, yeah, if you're from here, you know, these guys are assholes, man. They're just a specific type of cop who have even more types of shitty rules. So
explain the Mounties to us in case, because I guess I'm not familiar with them really.
Oh God. And I mean, it's the Royal Canadian Mounted Police they're a subset of like, I don't know, like fucking super cop. Like we got cops and we got sheriffs and like, what if fucking now sheriffs are, they're mostly like highway jurisdiction type thing. The Royal Canadian Mounted Police, the RCMP they were traditionally horse cops. And out here, it's one of those like it's the best of the best. It's the noble. And they've got these really fucking smart uniforms. And you always see them at like Olympic events and on our coins and shit like that. And they're really presented like those dudes outside of fucking Buckingham Palace, like that kind of like,
they're just ornamental.
It's a very noble thing. And it's like, no, a friend of mine's mom was in the RCMP and she quit because they do not treat women very well. And she fucking tried to stick it out. And it is really hard. The level of just like sexual abuse that goes on. And again, like they're one of those groups that also like, and the way that people talk about the like, yeah, originally like cops were formed to keep slaves in line. The RCMP were just a way to fucking kill natives. And now they're whitewashed into this fucking symbol of something else.
And I think that is definitely what it is that a lot of this history has been, you know, whitewashed. Well, just like how we still have, you know, Columbus Day. And it's just absolutely ridiculous that we celebrate that man. It blows my fucking mind. But, you know, I understand. It's just, and nobody really, you know, the common folk don't really stop to ask questions about it. So they don't really stop to really learn. And that's kind of where the issues just continue to kind of continue. You know, they just continue to be what it is, just a terrible history that everybody just kind of turns a blind eye to.
Are you a Rush fan?
Why?
Man, because I've been listening to Behind the Bastards, I was like, Rush Limbaugh? No. No, I'm the wrong era for that. For a while I lived with a couple of dudes who were both 10 years older than me and were from the East Coast, and all they listened to was Rush and Slayer. But my drop for fucking Canadian music, for fucking everybody listening at home, fucking go out and listen to some fucking, they were a hip hop band out of Toronto called BTK, but then the BTK killer became a thing and they kind of faded away.
That's the first thing I thought of.
Yeah, it standed for birth through knowledge, but yeah, the Google searching them is kind of a hassle now.
Yeah, I'm sure. Oh no.
But if you look up BTK Peppy Rock, I guarantee you have heard that song before. It'll be like, oh yeah, I heard this in 7 movies back in 1992 or 96.
Yeah,
it's Idle Hands.
Hitman, Brett the Hitman Hart, Wrestling with Shadows.
What?
Yes.
I guess it was on that soundtrack.
They were on that as well.
Well, I'm going
to. Well, they're great. They do a music video with Muppets in it and they talk about smoking weed. What else do you want?
And that sounds pretty great to me.
Yeah. Sign me up. Is weed legal there? I think it would be, right?
Yeah. I know at least here, like it's fully decriminalized and what's the fuck like recreational weed. Like you can just walk down a store into a government weed store or a non-government weed store and buy a bunch of weed and go home.
When did that happen for you guys?
You know, the funny thing is like I kept buying through my fucking regular dealer for like a year and a half after it started.
It's cheaper,
so like,
right?
It just,
the dispensary, you pay Coke prices for weed. It's kind of outlandish, but sometimes you can get pretty cool products too. So
some are good and some are bad. I think the government weed stores are pretty awful, but like there's ways, like there's delivery places where I can buy weed at half the price that I was buying it at previously. So, and some friendly dude brings it to your door.
Yeah, it's decriminalized completely in Illinois now. So we have dispensaries. They're not run by the government, though. It's interesting that you say that, but it would make sense because you guys have government health care, and these dispensaries are basically, they were set up initially for medicinal patients, and then they opened their doors to recreational people once that passed. Because that's kind of what they do in the states is first this, for, you know, it's done state by state. It's not a federal thing. So like where Ashley lives, like it's still illegal, but where I'm at in Illinois,
it's not illegal here,
but medicinal is, but not recreational.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah. Okay.
Different. Yeah. So like what a state will do first, like, you know, where Ashley's at is they'll decriminalize it for medicinal use. And then the dispensaries all pop up. And then if you have a prescription, you can go to it and you can get it. But it's all done privately because we do private health care. And then that usually lasts for about a year or two. And once they see that people aren't killing themselves in the streets and shit, then they'll go in the head and they'll pass the recreational law, which makes it legal for just about everybody to use.
Well, I'm almost positive. I'm about 99% sure it was decriminalized federally last year. It's you cannot be arrested for having pot anywhere in the entire country at this point. Now you can be fined, and then it's up to the state to decide how they want to regulate it, but you can't go to jail any longer.
But I think it's still a class, it's still a controlled substance. I know that the money still has to stay in the states. They don't allow, like when you go into the dispensaries, you have to pay in cash, because if you use a credit card or a debit card or any kind of banking card, that means that the money is kind of even electronically traveling over state lines, and that's where it gets tricky. So whenever you go to buy stuff, you always have to use cash because it has to be done right then and there. And they also have to grow whatever they sell in the stores. They have to grow it in the same state that they sell it because they don't want it traveling across state lines and stuff. It's weird here. We're halfway to, it sounds like we're halfway to where you guys are at. But yeah, that's been kind of a new thing for us here. I think 2 years ago or a year and a half ago, it became legal here in Illinois. And I mean, that was kind of weird as somebody that smoked pretty much since they were 15 or whatever, to have it suddenly be legalized and normalized. And you can talk about it at work with people, and it's not that was a pretty big cultural shift, you know?
I still haven't adjusted to it. Like, I still find myself like changing my words in the way of like I'm hiding something dirty. And it's like, well, no, that dude over there just said I had a beer last night. So right. I am also allowed to say I smoked a bowl last night. Like, I'm high right now, no matter when this is being broadcast. So like, but there is that weird, like, yeah, I guess we're not cool anymore. We're not breaking any law. We're not doing anything shifty. Like, now I'm just a fucking nerd with a pipe.
I had to make that decision when discussing it with my child. And I did that recently because it was 4:20 not too long ago. And, I slipped up and I told my mom that I was going to go get high, and my kid was right there, and I really didn't think about it. My kid's 9, and I'm like, you know, it wouldn't, like, if in front of my kid, if I was like, oh, I'm going to go drink, you know, not that I talk about drinking with my 9-year-old, but you know, if I said I'm going to drink a beer in front of her, like, it's, she's not going to freak out. You know what I mean? She's going to be like, oh, and you know, and let's be honest, you know, marijuana is not nearly as bad as alcohol is, not even close. And so I really had to like think about it. Like I said, I kind of made that decision, and I'm like, you know what? I either believe that marijuana is good and good for you and a great thing, or I don't. And I kind of need to decide that now and decide what kind of environment I want to raise my kid in to think, you know, these things. So I told her, I sat down, we had a great conversation about marijuana. I was telling her all about it. I was talking about how I can help people with certain things. And she was like, I want to have some marijuana. And I was like, oh no,
of course you do.
Backfired. So, you know, whatever. But we had a good talk about, you know, waiting until you're old enough and all that good stuff. So,
right. Which is what, 15, 14?
I mean, hey, as long as she gets the good stuff, I'm down with it. We can smoke down, play some Mario, you know.
See, I read comic books. That's what I would do. I would walk home from the comic book store and smoke my little one hitter and then go up to my room and read comic books for hours every, I don't know, what was it, Tuesday or Wednesday? What's new comic book day?
And people said that we weren't going to turn out right. Yeah. Look at us now. Now I drive the bus.
It's great. No, it's great.
It's so weird. It's, I think, like, I could have sworn I just saw a clip of some fucking American politician trying to decry weed and say something about the, like, how harmful it was to communities. And it just sounds so fucking backwards to hear somebody saying that now. Like, it's been a couple of years here at least. And, like, it's one of those, like, you guys can see us, right? Like we're right fucking there. Right. Like, hey, we socialized medicine and we're all really fucking like high and we're cool with it. Like we didn't burn shit down. It's fine.
Yeah. But,
you know.
Yeah.
Well, that's you know, what Fox News will show you.
I had this story, you know, not really a story, but it happened back in the summer. I went to this kid's birthday party. It was a 3-year-old's birthday party. And, you know, I was one of my friend's kids and I show up and, you know, they rolled this huge blunt. And we all smoked it together. But the thing was that the person that rolled that huge blunt was a lawyer. And so, you know, I mean, it's so silly how much like reefer madness is still a thing. I mean, it's obviously it's died down a lot, but it's just it's like, guys, it's 2021. We need to move past that part of our life, you know?
Well, I think some people just never had any exposure to it. And if you were the type of kid that smoked when you were in high school, even though it was illegal, you kind of, it normalized it to you and you realized that it wasn't that big of a deal and it wasn't that scary.
Yeah.
But if you're somebody that wasn't, if you're somebody that followed the rules or just wasn't, didn't have cool friends or whatever, however this stuff appeared on your radar. I mean, you know, I assume that there's some kids that could have gone their whole entire life and or not their whole entire life, but gone through their whole entire adolescence and never been exposed to criminal behavior. I wasn't one of them, but like, I'm sure there's kids out there like that,
yeah.
You know, just based on who their peers were or who was in their vicinity. And, you know, what do those kids do? This is something that I made a huge impact on me in high school. I went to school with kids that legitimately like didn't know black people. Like they grew up in these white suburbs. There was no black people anywhere around. Their parents didn't have black friends or they didn't associate with anybody. They didn't know anybody. And where they went to grammar school was, you know, proximity based to where they grew up. And there was no black kids there. There was no black teachers. And then they went to high school and there wasn't a huge number of black students at the high school I went to, but there was a few and you could tell that some kids were like legitimately seeing these like black people for the first time. Like they saw them on TV and shit. Like they knew they existed, but like as far as interaction on a daily basis or anything, it never fucking happened before. Same with Hispanics, same thing with just other races, non-whites. Like this was their first interaction with them. And it was just solely based on exposure and the bubbles that they grew up in. And, you know, Chicago for as being as big of a city as, I mean, it's the third largest city in the United States, it's ridiculously segregated. And it's very easy to grow up isolated from a lot of different things. And I have to feel that the people in this day and age that are still anti-marijuana and it still want to see it criminalized and still demonize it, it's got to just be a matter of no exposure.
Yeah.
None whatsoever. Because if you were exposed to it and you did try it and you did see people that used it, you wouldn't have those views. So the only way you could really conceivably have those views is if you have no exposure.
I know that my mom, she smoked pot once with my father. And when she did, and my dad did all the drugs in the world, and my mom did none. And when she finally smoked pot for the first time, she freaked out so badly that she had to go to the emergency room.
So. Well, we've all been there.
I'm like, are you sure it was just pot? And she's like, I just like, listen, I don't know. I just know I'm never doing it ever again. And I'm like, okay. Poor thing.
You're like, Mom, that's atypical though.
Right. You know. Right. I'm like, that shouldn't have happened. I mean, I don't know. You know, I don't know. I've gotten pretty high before, but like, going to the hospital. I don't know. So, I mean, for her, it was traumatizing. So, I mean, maybe some of these other people have that experience and they're like, oh, this is what it's like every time you get, you know, because everybody's got that first time they get high, right? And it is, it can be very intense. And, you know, so it just, maybe that's what happens. And instead of, you know, them just being like, oh, I'll return back to normal, they have this freak out and it's scary forever.
It took me about 5 years to get shit my pants high. And there's a video, it's a YouTube video, but it's an audio recording of an off-duty cop that takes an edible and then calls 911 because he thinks that him and his girlfriend are dying.
I've seen that.
I've been that high before.
Yeah.
And once again, it was from edibles. I had made a batch of brownies and I did not make them correctly. And all hell broke loose. And I mean, it's possible, but luckily I called my brother-in-law before I called 911. And I said, am I dying? Am I turning into an angel? What the fuck is happening? And he's like, shut the fuck up, get off the phone and go watch Wayne's World or something. And you're going to be fine in 2 hours. And I was, you know, I guess like I was able to put my head back together again.
Okay, calm down. And,
yeah. I walked out of that apartment.
Yeah.
Yeah. Unless I'm still there.
I was going to say, you'll be fine. You'll just start a podcast in 20 years.
Yep.
Oh, man.
I think my advantage was that I was super straight edge all the way through high school because I had a lot of alcoholics around me and that they kind of forced me into that direction.
Right.
And so then I got into acid before I started smoking weed. Yes. So weed was never a big deal. I was always able to handle it after that.
I can definitely see why. That's there you go. Another anecdote about my parents. My dad, my mom was in labor with my sister and she called my dad and he was tripping on acid and he showed up to the hospital. They had to get him a room. I had a weird childhood also, guys. I'm sorry.
I mean, I can see a level of like, yeah, man, that would be fucking beautiful. But also like, get out of here. Get out of here. Hi. We're trying to bring a child into this world.
Right. Yeah. No, I wouldn't. I don't know how he survived that night, to be honest with you.
Jesus.
How were your acid trips? Would you characterize them as mostly positive? Did you think they influenced you creatively? Did you take anything away from them, or was it just an interesting way to spend 12 hours?
I still really like acid. Like, it's still, if I could do it without it fucking me up so badly that I can't, like, you know, just the depression that kind of kicks in a couple of days afterwards.
Yeah.
I've done a lot of acid over the past few years and I love it. I, you know, initially there was this like, hey, I'm having a fucking transcendental experience. And then after a while it's like, hey, I'm going to watch 7 hours of Adventure Time. And like, those are both cool experiences. And like, eventually you're not a fucking 19-year-old, you know, like let's take it all the way back to what we were talking about before. Of like,
me and you need to fucking hang out, dude. Seriously.
There's this era of time where I'm just reading The Invisibles and I'm doing a lot of acid and I'm trying to make it all real. You know, I'm trying to make it feel like it's this thing that's manifesting. And I remember I found a store where I could buy some DMT and I had a moment where I was super excited about that. But then I spoke to the person who worked in the store and they were this fucking space cadet. And I just remember I walked out and I was like, these doors aren't fucking real. Like, I love acid. I love the way it makes me feel. I love the thoughts and like the ways it takes me. But the part of me that's like, and now we're going to fucking sync up with the UFOs. We're going to go do some, like, it's just a bunch of shit inside my head. It doesn't mean anything except as a, you know, like, it means as much as a fucking painting does, you know, like, it might be expressing something from within myself, but it doesn't, like, there's no cosmic significance to any of it.
Yeah. So Ashley, did you want to ask him about the DMT or did, you know? So I'm giving you opportunity to talk now. It's good to hear your voice again.
Oh, well, no, okay. So I don't, you know, Hank, I'm sure you know a little bit about myself. I'm a, you know, when I'm not talking weird on Wednesdays, I am a 40-year investigator full time. So what that means is that I chase things like cryptids and aliens and ghosts and pretty much everything. So what I have found with DMT is that a lot of these people that do it have a very similar experience. So that's, I think that's very interesting coming from a perspective where you're like, oh, it's all in my head. Do you really think that it is? You don't think there's any type of significance there?
This is a really tricky thing because like I'm a cynic and I'm a believer to a degree.
Sure.
I think these things play off the mind. Okay, I haven't done DMT, but I did my strongest hallucinogenic experiences were when I smoked a bunch of salvia while taking acid. Okay, and those were the moments where I truly lost myself for periods of time and genuinely saw shit like I was taking acid in a cartoon. Okay. And they were really powerful, profound experiences. But at the same time, I recognize that dreams often feel really profound because they're pushing a button in your brain that says that they feel profound. You know, it's like this weird fucking, this guy, Michael Swaim, used to always have this thing of like, would you rather watch a good movie? Or if you could take a pill that convinced your brain that you had watched a good movie, isn't that just as good as having that experience?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I agree with that. So what ultimately shied you away from wanting to do the DMT? Because here's the thing is that, you know, I've also partaken in quite a few of the drugs. And, you know, we discussed this in our general drugs episode was that, stuff like acid, things like that, you don't really hallucinate, right? It just gives you a different perspective. It gives you a different lens to view the world, right? And that's basically what you're saying is that, you know, you just, it doesn't change that you're looking at a field of flowers. It just changes how you view that field of flowers, right? But DMT is just a whole nother beast. It seems like these people actually like physically leave and go somewhere. I mean, they talk about entering portals and entering the world. Now the thing is that they all talk about seeing these specific creatures, and not just like, so they do see different creatures. However, when they enter this different world, they'll see like, I don't know, a caterpillar man standing next to, you know, a cat person, and the caterpillar man talks to them. But then you have Joe Schmo, who also did DMT, and he saw both as well, except this time it was the cat person that interacted with them. I mean, do you have any type of opinion on that? Would you be willing to try it one day to see if you have that experience?
I would be totally willing to try it. I know me and my partner have talked about it a number of times. I think just me and her are both a little cynical about those experiences. And I want to be clear too, of like, some of the reason I'm cynical about drugs is because I had extremely unrealistic expectations of drugs. Like the reason I didn't want to do DMT is because sometime around 20 or 21, I recognized that no matter how much DMT I do, I'm not going to be telekinetic. And that bums me out, you know?
Yeah.
And there's a degree of that's the only reason I was fucking doing it. I was doing these drugs because I read this fucking comic book that said we'd be X-Men and have cool mutant powers and like money wouldn't matter. We'd just travel the world and have crazy adventures.
100%.
And instead, I'm just kind of a depressed guy without a girlfriend who's super high. That's me at 20.
That was me at 20 as well. 100%. Oh my God. That was me at 20 as well.
That's so funny. Well, yeah. I definitely don't want to knock the fact that you have a degree of skepticism. And I do want to remind the listeners and pretty much anybody that gets into this kind of weird world is that, you know, a huge part of my job is being a skeptic. You know, I have to prove because I believe in all of these things that are very fringe and very out there, but I believe that there's a way for us to prove them with science. So when somebody comes at me with a claim, like maybe say they have the largest dick on the planet, and this is a callback to a previous guest. But if somebody comes at me with a claim, I have to deduce what it isn't first, right? So I have to go through all the avenues of what we naturally know in order to find, you know, something else. And then once I find out, listen, this doesn't fall in any category of any known science, then now we can start talking about science that we haven't even discovered. But I do appreciate the look and the outlook and the insight for me to take with me, because I am making a documentary on DMT with Pat, actually. So.
Well, we were going to videotape ourselves taking it and see what happens. I've kind of cleaned up my act a little bit because, like you, I realized that, you know, there was an expiration date for kind of doing that stuff and expecting worlds to open up to you. And I drank the Kool-Aid, the Invisibles Kool-Aid, and kind of tried to go down as far as I could with it. And I mean, there's even kind of a warning in there when at the end of the first trade paperback, when Marcus de Sade comes out and he's in that like S&M bar in San Francisco, and they're talking to the dude in the Gimp mask, and they're talking about how you know, acid was supposed to change the world, and it was just another vehicle that people abused because they were hoping that would do all the work for them. You know, everyone thought that, you know, Ken Kesey and the Merry Pranksters, we were just going to hop on this bus and drop this acid, and the world was going to change around us, and it was people trying to avoid doing the work themselves. And that's the thing, is that these drugs can show you, they can show you the door, but they're not going to walk you through the door. That's up to you. And if you want to change the world, you have to be the change that you want to see in the world. And it's a lot more complicated than just getting high a whole bunch. And, you know, I kind of did a number on myself, like you were talking about with the depression and shit. I had done a lot of ecstasy. That was like kind of the big thing up here. And ecstasy up here was cut with heroin a lot. So you would roll your fucking face off, and then you would go through opioid withdrawals. You'd have lockjaw the next day, and you couldn't fucking talk, you know? And it was a good time, and, you know, you'd be just rolling your fucking face off, and then you'd crash. And, you know, when I started all that, I wasn't single, but it didn't take long for me to become single because I was fucking crazy. You know, if I wasn't higher than fucking squirrel nuts, I was depressed and like moody and and just not in a good place, you know. And you know, after high school, those are tough years anyway, because you're trying to figure out what the fuck happens next. And the amount of drugs that I was pumping into my system and the number I was doing on my brain was not good. And, you know, newsflash, like, I hate, you know, or I guess spoiler alert's a better way to put it. No, I never became an invisible. I'm just a fucking dude now, you know, and I never became a superhero. And as much as I tried and as much as I, you know, tried to use that comic book as a fucking instruction book, it never happened. Not to say that I didn't learn a lot, not to say that I didn't have some good times. And
The same time, though, like, there is something weird going on here, you know, because like, I'm like meeting those guys through the Mobcast. That's changed things for me, like interacting with those guys and getting to know them. And like, I can't tell you how many experiences I've had in the shop. Like, that's my fucking book that I push. I've pushed it to a lot of people over the years. And sometimes people come back and they'll say, of like, you probably don't remember me, but 7 years ago, you sold me the Invisibles and my life changed for a while. And it's weird. My mom always had this thing about fucking slow magic, that everything fucking takes so much longer than you think it will, but that doesn't mean it's not happening. And there are points where you and I are having these conversations, even some of our interactions just on Twitter and shit, where it's like, is this it? Like, is some of it starting to fucking unravel in a weird way? Not unravel, almost like connect, the opposite of that. At the same time, like, we're not doing cool superpowered shit, but like, I don't know, maybe we can make cool art and that's good too.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not downplaying the influence that book had in my life. I just think that I'm with you. Like, I realized that it wasn't going to be as easy as I hoped it was. And you're right. I mean, I still celebrate that book, and it was a part of my life, you know, and it's trying to show it to Asher's, and she was like, I don't know, I don't read comic books. I'm like, but it's not that, you know, and there are so much of it, so much of the stuff that was in there that you're right, slow magic, that it feels like it's come to fruition now. You know, it didn't happen in 2000, it didn't happen in 2021 or 2012. But I feel like that thing's more relevant than ever, you know, and with my interest in DMT and, you know, doing the documentary and stuff, and when my ears perked up when you mentioned it, is that is something that I think that I would come out of retirement for. Not that I'm in partying retirement, but, you know, I feel like that's something that it's got my interest again to where I kind of want to check that out. you know, and I'll be honest, a lot of it too is just the logistics of it. It lasts a half an hour as opposed to 13 hours, 14 hours, you know, and I don't have as much free time on my hands as I used to.
You just want to get in there, get the trip, and get the hell home.
Get in there, meet the aliens, and then, yeah, get home in time for Letterkenny.
Oh, that does sound nice. I think we're going to eat some mushrooms sometime in the next week or so. It wasn't a bad experience, but we did that thing of like, let's eat mushrooms and then watch a terrible movie. And we watched The Third Crow and like, yeah, it turns out that's a terrible movie.
That's such a bizarre pick.
Next time, I think we're going to do Speed Racer.
Oh, man. I tried to rewatch that recently. It's fucking trippy as balls still. You know, I can't wait for that new Matrix movie. I'm very interested to see where they go with that franchise.
Oof. I mean, that's another it almost came up a few minutes ago when I was like, man, I shouldn't even mention the fucking Matrix because we don't have the time to get into all of that. But like, I want to be excited about the fucking new Matrix. But I saw the other two, you know, like it's so fucking hard to have faith in something that shit the bed so badly.
Well, I don't malign the second one the way some people do. I thought the second one was okay. The third one, I felt like they didn't have enough material for two more movies. You know what I mean? I felt like the third one really wore out its welcome. That whole opening scene with the Keymaster on the subway station, whatever the fuck that was, they should have just made the second movie like 3 hours long and brought in the mech suits and then called it a day. They really dragged it out too much, but I don't hate the sequels. I really like the Animatrix. You know, I revisited that.
Animatrix is fucking great.
Yeah. I revisited that not too long ago and I love that. And, I was a big fan of Sense8. I don't know if you ever caught that. That was their Netflix series.
No, I had weird feelings about J. Michael Straczynski. I hate the way I pass through all of these things of like, oh, that show sounds really cool. Yeah, I know two things about that writer, so I didn't watch it. Not to say there's anything like he's not a fucking creep or anything. I just don't care for J. Michael Straczynski. It's sort of like the Damon Lindelof thing. I'm not saying he's a fucking piece of shit or anything. I just don't want him talking to me for 2 hours.
Okay. You didn't watch the Watchmen series?
No, but I also, okay. A few years ago, one of my coworkers gave me a shirt that said Alan Moore's number one fan. And I try to wear it with a certain degree of pride. What the fuck? Even my store was at one point voted, you know, fucking local papers have their shitty, like, hey, top 10 places for this. And my comic shop got rated the number one place to read Alan Moore comics. So I like to think that I take my Alan Moore-ness pretty seriously. I do have a real like, yeah, man, I won't. That's stolen material. Like you don't touch something that was supposed to be like it's doomed. It's all fucking, it's cursed land. Even when it's good, I think most of the people who worked on that show are wonderful human beings and I wish them really good careers and I wish I could have fucking indulged with it. But yeah, man, it's a real like fucking pig's a filthy animal and I don't fucking dig on swine.
I can appreciate that level of fanaticism, I guess.
It's unhealthy.
maybe that's not the right word to use. No, because I was never a huge Alan Moore fan, so I didn't feel that way. And the fact that he turned his back on it, or not turned his back on it, but just said the comic was what it was, and we're not going to do sequels, and we're not going to do spinoffs, we're not going to do all this shit. And the fact that DC did them anyway is kind of, you know, unfortunate that they have the right to do that with someone's intellectual property. And I heard those comic books were absolutely abysmal and I never picked them up or read them. But the TV show I enjoyed and I'll just leave it at that. I'm not going to try to sell you on it because I think that's a lost cause, but.
No, and I don't want to ever take anything away from anybody. Like, there was no part of me that was like, oh, that fucking bullshit show and its bullshit message. Like, no, it looked great. It looked like all the people who worked on it worked really fucking hard. There is just a like, oh, I'm sorry, I fucking cut my hand and bled and promised servitude to this wizard 20 years ago, so I still can't watch your show, HBO.
But you know what's crazy is that I didn't even really pick up on the irony of this until right now. But Damon Lindelof refused to do a sequel to it. because he felt that, like, because, you know, obviously that show came out and it was critically acclaimed and everybody loved it. So, of course, they immediately went a second season. And he was like, no, we did everything we needed to do with the first one. We're just going to leave it alone. And I'm like, yeah, that sounds fucking familiar.
Weird, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that rise. Would also open us on to having a larger conversation. Did you, and I shouldn't even fucking ask this, but we're pushing on to fucking almost 2 hours, but like, did you watch Lost?
No, I dated all girls right. that watched Lost. So it was always on in the background, but I never really got into it. I remember the reveal that they had to go watching the episode where you realize that they're already off the island. And they're at like the wake for John and, you know, what's his name? The guy, we need to go back,
Kate. Yeah.
Yeah. Like I remember seeing Matthew that Fox. Being like, holy shit. And like thinking that was like next level storytelling.
Matthew Fox right then and there. I mean, not right then and there, but like that era would have been a really good Cyclops.
Yeah, I could see that.
I just like to throw that out there. He's too old for it. None of this has any meaning now, but I still like to keep that alive.
Well, Hank, thanks for coming out. Yeah. Talking to us.
Hey, thanks for having me on here. This was a lot of fun.
Is there anything you want to plug? Give your socials and all that stuff. Please, the Twitter and the YouTube and all that stuff.
All the important stuff I do is through Death by Media Man. You can find me like I'm whatever fucking HLH Pattison at Twitter, but like the Death by Media Man, which you can go to deathbymediaman.com or you can look it up on YouTube or it has a Twitter account. Everything important I do, the videos, the writing, the comic books gets funneled through that. That's my little production company thing.
Okay, perfect. Thank you for listening, guys. We do hope that you enjoyed this. If you did, make sure you subscribe to the new People Who Make Stuff podcast anywhere you listen to podcasts. And also be sure to leave a rating and review if you're listening on Apple or iTunes podcast. And definitely let us know if you have things that you make and you would like to be featured on the show. Feel free to contact either myself or Pat, which of course our social media links are always in the description. If not, most of you already follow us on social media. It really doesn't matter. We're both pretty open. And, you know, hopefully we will bring you guys some more quality content in the future.